C2A. Number 4A.
We come to the seventh big main subject of the chapter, Dominant Eucharist. And the epitomes of that chapter you have in the blue book on the epitome for the structure of the Christian Science textbook. And for this chapter also, in order that you have a better overall view, we printed this matrix. That matrix, which has in the upper corner on the left-hand side, has number one, so that this really is the matrix that covers the main subject plus the seven subtones of the main subject. It is the same text as you have in the blue book that you have here in this presentation. And what we will do at the present moment is just first to have an overall view of the seven main tones without considering the subtones in the matrix one, number one that you have. Those main tones are written out on the top of the matrix in the seven columns. And we want first to go quickly through those seven in order to get a general view of the subject. In order to understand perhaps a bit better what the second chapter wants to teach is to remember really what the first chapter on prayer tried to do. In the first chapter on prayer, you had asked these epitomes of the main tones, always an attitude that would bring us into unity with God. We had in prayer that the first prayer was the prayer of true desire to know God as He is, which would bring us into unity with the all-intelligence active mind. So can you see in prayer these sevenfold epitomes were constantly accentuating how we are getting into unity with God. Now, the second chapter, Atonement and Eucharist, starts out from that unity with God. It takes that as established and says, now what happens when through prayer we have established our unity with God? And then you see, when we run through the main tone here in this matrix, that mind would show that through man's unity with mind, which was established in the prayer, we are enabled to act according to the law of atonement. So you can see that man begins to reflect God, as Mrs. Eddy said, that atonement is the exemplification of man's unity with God, whereby man reflects truth, life, and love, so that in man something is impelled to act according in mind, according to the law of atonement. When we know the tonality of the synonymous term, you can easily detect here mind. And I will do that all through the week. I will always, when we talk about the ideas, that I will say, look here, this is mind, this is spirit, this is soul. So as your ear gets accustomed to the tonality of the synonyms. So if through prayer I have found my unity with the all-intelligent mind, then that has a Christ within itself. And it begins to come to us and impel within us that we are acting and doing and acting according to the law of atonement. You get the tone of mind as that which does, that acts, that is a law. When we come to spirit, then, we see that through prayer, we have found our unity with spirit through activating and reflecting divine qualities and spiritual qualities. If we find that inner consciousness that is one with spirit, that does something in Atonement and Eucharist. It begins to compel us towards complete spiritualization. It is that if we touch spirit, then spirit will not let us go anymore until we are completely spiritualized. It therefore compels us to spiritualization. You can easily hear in here the tone of spirit. In the third subject, we arrive through prayer, the third prayer of soul, where we have that prayer of sinlessness, which rebukes sin. We arrive at the unity with soul, with the sinlessness of soul, and that has a Christ. The moment we touch our unity with soul, the Christ begins to operate. At the same time, the idea begins to do something within us. Namely here, it begins to bestow on us consistency. It's consistency, soul, which leads us safely along the way from sense to soul. So that we have here a sense that if our prayer is right, and our consciousness becomes acquainted with soul, the sinlessness of soul, that begins to operate within us as the Christ and says, I give you the consistency, the perseverance, that you go along the way from sense to soul. So that we see that not we have to go the way from sense to soul, but that soul itself has a Christ, and it's the Christ's power in the messianic work, that soul itself doesn't let us anymore at rest until we go along the way from sense to soul, and in that way gives us the persistency to go along that way. If we come to principle, we know that in principle, the prayer of principle said that the prayer is the prayer of obedience to God, which brings everything within us in line with God, so that everything accords with God, and that brings us into unity with the impersonal working of principle. That was prayer. Well, if we are brought into unity with the impersonal working of principle, then the Christ begins to operate in Atonement and Eucharist and says, through man's unity with principle, we are divinely empowered. That gives us the authority of spiritual power. You know, spiritual power as an idea of principle, it's that fourth term in the third degree of the translation of Immortal Mind. So, again, we can see something very clearly, that the student always longs, say, for spiritual power, that he has the divine power within himself, that he is divinely empowered, and he may ask himself, how do I get that power? Well, science tells us how to get it. It says, don't start with that sense that we should have divine power, start with prayer. This is the beginning. Start out with prayer. Be first really prayerful in being obedient to God, in bringing everything honestly in line with God, and that brings you into unity with God, and that then gives you, without that you have to work for it, gives you then divine power. And we are divinely empowered. So it is also with the fifth main subject, where in prayer we begin to see that prayer must include really the willingness to have deep devotion deep-felt devotion to God that is willing really to sacrifice everything, to sacrifice a material, personal sense of life. And only that brings us step by step into unity with life. If something then within us becomes united and acquainted with life, God, then that unity operates in Atonement and Eucharist here through man's unity with life. What happens? We are actually then empowered to lay down the material concept of life and thereby free us from the belief in persecution. The moment we don't have any more a material sense of life, we can no more be persecuted, because persecution always needs a person, a personal life, which it can persecute. And so we had in the sixth prayer that prayer of truth, which said it's a prayer of spiritual consciousness, where we close our consciousness to error, let only truth flow in, where we are in that sanctuary of truth, where we only are conscious of true ideas, and that brings us into unity with the dominion of truth. Then we touch truth, which gives us dominion, and that dominion then has a Christ. It comes to us in Atonement and Eucharist here as truth, that through man's unity with truth, the true manhood is being established in us. There, then, for the first time, we begin to realize that we begin to see man as idea. And for the first time, then, the term idea is used in the textbook. So that only at this point we begin to realize that we are at one or at one moment with the idea man. That's the sixth. Then we come to the seventh point, the main tone, where we also saw in prayer that the prayer of love, the seventh prayer, was that prayer where we were glorifying in consciousness the perfection of being, and that only by admitting the perfection of being constantly we are brought into unity with the one love, and that love is showing us the complete trustworthiness of God's care, that love would meet all human needs. How would it do it? It is showing that this meeting of the human needs is not our meeting the human needs, that it must always be that God, the Christ, is the power in the messianic work, and therefore shows in Atonement and Eucharist, in the last big subject of love, really that through man's unity with love, atonement with God fulfills itself in us and ends up that we are really then one with the whole Christianity of love, with the whole sense of divine science as a comforter, which is all-embracing, universal, and where there is nothing anymore that is outside the infinite one. So that last tone of love is a very long subject. It is longer than all the six preceding subjects, because love is always the guiding concept, the guiding concept of God in Atonement and Eucharist. Why? And we'll see that very often. We'll see that in the text, quite unexpectedly, Mrs. Eddy would always bring in the synonymous term love, because love is that which enforces atonement, because love is that which does not rest until all is atoned. And therefore one gets in that second chapter a terrific sense that atonement is not in the first place really our desire to atone, but that fundamentally in being there is such a factor that says being is love, being cannot see anything that is not pure, that is not perfect, and therefore draws all to itself, draws all to the point of perfection. And this is constantly felt here in that text. We'll see that unexpectedly Mrs. Eddy will speak about love, because that is the plane of love that goes right through the textbook, through the second chapter. That last subject of love, which we have here in the last column, has a very delicate layout. It has not only the seven subtones, but it has a 7x7 subtones, and therefore that is then brought out in the matrix number 2, which you also have. That matrix number 2 gives the matrix just of the main tone of love. And when that main tone of love comes to love as truth, then it does not show just love as truth in seven subtones, but even further in a wider, delicate filigree means or filigree form. It shows then love as truth in the days of creation order, and that is then to be shown in the matrix number 3 that you have. But at the moment, we put away matrix 2 and 3, and we are just concerned with the matrix 1, which is giving a very consistent layout of 7x7, just as we had in the chapter on prayer. So, can we see that the very first thing we always have to keep in mind when we are thinking about the chapter Atonement and Eucharist, that we always consider it as a second chapter, which means that actually, in order that the second chapter can be demonstrated, we first have to build a proper basis through prayer. So that we are not constantly starting out, say, with the second chapter, with the feeling that God should come to us and heal us and save us, but that we see that this is only possible, or that we only let in really the Christ idea, if first through prayer we have prepared our consciousness for the influx of the Christ idea, that therefore the source, the well from which we draw, is actually the first chapter, and that the second chapter is then more the activity of that first chapter. Therefore, every treatment starts, so to say, with a prayerful attitude. No matter which chapter in the textbook we contemplate, all these chapters that have a beautiful layout, that we can understand through a beautiful layout, they only have really power, they only have really living value when they are built first on prayer. When there is within ourselves a prayerful contemplation of our understanding of God, and not just a thinking contemplation of what God is, therefore there must be a culture of that prayer attitude. That then is that seed, is that basis, is that ground into which then the Christ idea can be sown and begins to operate. Now, let's see how Mrs. Eddy develops the first big subject of mind. And you can either follow that either through that matrix number 1 by going down the column vertically, or by using the epitomes as you have them in the epitome book. So let's investigate the first subject of mind. What do we do in order to interpret the textbook such that it yields really the spiritual story that the divine mind wanted to bring out in the textbook? We always have to remember that it was God who dictated the text. That the text is not something that Mrs. Eddy made up, that it is not a premeditated text, but that she was listening to what the divine mind was revealing to her, and she wrote it down. No matter if she understood what he wrote or didn't understand what he wrote, that she didn't mind. She was just a scribe under order and was writing down what God dictated. Now, what is God and who is God? God is not a mystical concept. God is, as it is revealed now, mind and spirit and soul, his principle, life, truth and love. Therefore, if mind dictates a text, then the text is mind-like. If spirit dictates a text, then it is spirit-like. Soul dictating a text, it's soul-like, and so on. Which means that we can only really read the text and interpret the text when we read it with that mind, which was also the mind that is God. Therefore, from the point of view of the seven synonymous terms, or of the fourfold calculus, from the capitalized terms. This is one of the big issues, that we are not reading the text with our human mind. The moment we read the text with our human mind, we read it in English. We read it the way the human mind has been trained to read words and sentences. And this does not reveal the content of the text. When we started out and saying God dictated the text, but God is not an Englishman. God does not know English. His language is the language of spirit, which means it is the language of spiritual tonality, of spiritual impact, of that's not a good term, of a spiritual atmosphere, of a consciousness that is spiritual. And therefore, we can only read the text if within our consciousness we have cultured really the consciousness of those capitalized terms. So that we read in the text not the English terms in the first place, but that we hear God speaking. And God is not single terms. God is always the capitalized terms. That's his language. That's his only language. And consequently, we can only really decode the Bible and the textbook if we entertain in our consciousness that language of spirit that does think, or that is conscious only of the tonality of those capitalized terms. This means that if we read a text, we must listen to the subject presented in the text. We are not reading the text by reading the terms and the words of the text. We read the tonality of it. We read the subject in it. We read the theme in it. And that theme is the theme that God dictated, and that is that which is the scientific interpretation of that text. So if you read, for instance, the beginning of Atonement and Eucharist and listen to the tonality of it, we will see that she maintains constantly a certain tonality until finally she breaks that tonality and begins with a completely different tonality. Say, after spirit with the tonality, after mind with the tonality of spirit. And naturally we hear that just as we see the difference between green and blue, just as we see the difference between red and orange. It's a break that comes in, though those, like the colors, they go into each other. So we see that one subject leads to the next one, flows into the next one, builds a bridge to the next one, in order to unfold a subject according to an order, so that the whole order flows through a chapter. So, what do we do when we read the text here? We do it again, as we said before, namely that we first read a text and listen to the main subject that comes up and comes up and comes up again and again and again. We listen tonality-wise to the text until we feel suddenly at one point, from one paragraph to the next, Mrs. Eddy changes the tonality, changes the synonymous term. If we do this here with mind and read through that text that is rather short in this case, only about a page and a half, if we read that through, we can't help hearing constantly one thing, namely always that mind says, go and do something along atonement. Go and do. It gives us at once the tonality of mind. We know mind as the active mind, mind that acts, that does, that is constantly doing things. And therefore, when we read such a section, such a theme, we perhaps do good if we make first notes on just these terms that indicate the tonality of the first subject. So if after a while we have listened to the text and have seen, well, the very first subject is about minds doing, minds acting, then what we can do, what I would propose you to do, is to take pencil and paper and go over the text again and just write out with single terms or two or three words the tonality that repeats itself constantly.